Lecture 14. Aeschylus, Part 2. Agamemnon.
In our last lecture, we talked about the first of our three Athenian tragic playwrights, Aeschylus. We discussed his life and technique and his earliest extant play, The Persians, that play about the Greek defeat of the Persians, primarily in the Battle of Salamis. In this lecture and the next, we turn to the three plays in his trilogy, The Oresteia. Agamemnon in this lecture, Libation Bearers, and Eumenides in the next lecture. I begin with some mythological background, then move right into Agamemnon. The Oresteia, our only surviving trilogy from antiquity, is a treatment of part of the mythological tradition centered in the cities of Argos and sometimes Mycenae. The Athenian audience would have known the mythological background to Aeschylus's version, so it's useful to start with a brief review of that. Please indulge me in a little storytelling. Let's start with Agamemnon's great-grandfather, Tantalus. And it's important to go back that far in the family, since family connections and family behavior do make such a difference in many of these myths. In fact, we've already met Tantalus in this course. He was in the underworld in Odyssey 11, one of the eternally damned that Odysseus saw during his visit. Tantalus was once a favorite of the gods, even invited to dine with them. But he abused that privilege. For some reason, maybe wanting to prove his superiority to the gods, he tried to fool them at a dinner by serving them his own son, Pelops, cut up in a stew. The gods saw through the trick, all except Demeter, who was distracted with grief about her daughter Persephone. Demeter ate a piece of his shoulder. The gods punished Tantalus for this terrible deed, sending him to the underworld, where he stood in a pool of clear, cool water. But whenever he tried to drink, the water evaporated into nothing. Branches heavy with fruit were just above his head. Whenever he reached for them, mysterious winds blew them away. Tantalizing indeed. What about Pelops? The gods reconstituted him, fitted him with an ivory shoulder to make up for the missing part. When Pelops came of age, he married Hippodamia, but the courtship was hardly normal. Her father had offered her in marriage to anyone who could outrace him in a chariot. As Pelops arrived on the scene to try for the marriage with Hippodamia, he saw the previous suitors for her hand, their heads on stakes around the city wall. Their chariots had been too slow. So Pelops decided to cheat, bribing the father's charioteer to rig that chariot, the father's chariot, by removing the linchpins that held the wheels onto the axle. Speeding along after Pelops, the father's wheels fell off the chariot, he crashed to his death, and Pelops won his bride. But Pelops refused to pay up his co-conspirator, the charioteer who'd fixed the chariot, and in the struggle, threw this guy over a cliff to his death. As he's dying, that charioteer cursed Pelops and his entire family for generations to come. Things are not going to go well in this family. Pelops went on to live in southern Greece and even named that part of the country after himself, the island of Pelops, the Peloponnesus. He had two sons, Atreus and Thyestes. Bad idea for a king to have two sons because they're never going to get along. Both of them were struggling for their father's throne. At one point, Thyestes seduced Atreus' wife to try to get the better of him. Atreus retaliated with the famous or infamous Feast of Thyestes. Atreus invited his brother Thyestes to dinner along with his family and served to his brother his own children chopped up in a stew. Family tendencies reemerging. There was one son of Thyestes who missed out on the feast and survived. That was Aegisthus, and we'll see more of him soon. Atreus had two sons, Menelaus and Agamemnon, who, in Aeschylus' version, ruled jointly in the city of Argos. Now, we've met these two before. They're married to sisters. Clytemnestra, married to Agamemnon, Helen, married to Menelaus. With the abduction of Helen, the two of them were off to the Trojan War, as we know. Under Agamemnon's leadership, all of the Greeks gathered at a particular spot to go to Troy. They gathered at the city of Aulis, but the winds were blowing against them and kept them in port. Why was this happening? A prophet explained the bad weather. Agamemnon has angered the goddess Artemis and has to offer her his own daughter Iphigenia as a sacrificial victim in order to appease Artemis and win for the Greeks favorable winds. So he does, and off they sail. That takes us pretty well up to the start of our trilogy. The trilogy starts back in Argos at the moment of the fall of Troy, 10 years after Iphigenia was sacrificed at Aulis and the great armament sailed away to Troy. Now, here briefly is what happens in each play before we start looking at Agamemnon in particular. In Agamemnon, the first play of the trilogy, Agamemnon returns from Troy. He returns home to Argos, bringing with him his war prize, Cassandra, only to be killed by his wife, Clytemnestra, with the help of her consort, Aegisthus. In the second play, The Libation Bearers, the two children of Agamemnon and Clytemnestra get together. Orestes comes back to Argos after a long exile, and his sister, Electra, joins him in avenging their father by killing their mother Clytemnestra and Aegisthus. Now, note that the Greek name for this second play, The Libation Bearers, is the Coephory. You'll sometimes see it referred to with that name. The third play in the trilogy is the Eumenides, sometimes translated as the Furies. The Eumenides brings the bloodshed to an end, all these murders, by transferring the site of vengeance from the family to the city, specifically to a court in Athens. Aeschylus seems to have preferred the trilogy format, unlike Sophocles and Euripides, who most often wrote groups of plays with little or no connection to each other. You remember each tragic playwright who was selected for performance at the festival wrote three plays. Aeschylus liked to do them in a trilogy group. The trilogy allows for the development of the same story with some of the same themes, images, characters over a larger span of time. Events, as in this trilogy that we're talking about, can unfold over generations. Okay, on to Agamemnon. Agamemnon enacts Clytemnestra's deceptive murder of Agamemnon. And especially in its long choral sections, the play introduces the imagery and the theme, many of them about justice, the way justice works, these themes that will be central throughout the trilogy. Structurally, this play is a Nostos story, a story about the return of Agamemnon from Troy. Our focus in this play is more squarely on the situation at home rather than on the events of the journey. The contrast with Odysseus's Nostos is striking. And Homer made much of that, as we saw, in the Odyssey, where Agamemnon in the underworld warned Odysseus to look out for his treacherous wife. The play opens in darkness, a watchman sitting on top of the palace of Agamemnon, waiting, as he's been waiting, for some sign, a beacon that will signal the end of the Trojan War. Clytemnestra, he tells us, has set him up there, and he dare not disobey her. Suddenly, the beacon appears. Great cause for joy and rejoicing. The beacon means that Troy has fallen and Agamemnon is on his way home. I can't wait to greet him, to shake his hand, says the watchman. But wait, he thinks. What is it that he's coming home to? I'll say no more, but if the house could speak, well, it could tell a story. But as for me, a great ox sits on my tongue. The chorus then files in, singing the long parados in this play. These are old men of Argos. They were too old even 10 years earlier to go off on the expedition to Troy. As in the Persians, there are a group of loyal citizens waiting, with some foreboding, as in the Persians. They're awaiting the return of their king from battle. They know nothing about the beacon that the watchman saw, nothing about the news from Troy. Reflecting on the war, the members of the chorus have great support for Agamemnon, and they see the expedition to Troy as being justified, sanctioned by Zeus. Yet they also recognize the cost of war. Off they went, the chorus remembers. They remember back to when they left from Aulis. Off they went, the twin-sceptered kings, Agamemnon and Menelaus, agents of Zeus. Zeus sent them against Paris. And then all of a sudden, that discordant note starts creeping in. He sent them against Paris, all for the sake of one many-manned woman, Helen. And there at Troy, these old men are now imagining, there at Troy, the fighting is brutal, with grinding knees, broken spears, pain and anguish for Greek and Trojan alike, all for one woman. But, say the chorus, let's hope it all turns out well. What will be, you can't change destiny. They pull back from making any conclusions about this. Still in the same song, these Argive elders recall Agamemnon's choice at Aulis, his decision when he was faced with the possibility of killing his daughter if he wanted to take the fleet over to Troy, or if he didn't kill his daughter, disbanding the army. As often in tragic situations, each choice brings with it difficult consequences, to say the least. The chorus takes us back to that moment at Aulis, and they quote Agamemnon's response to the prophet when he's learned what he's being asked to do. He's learned what the gods demand. This, the chorus imagines, or this the chorus remembers, is what Agamemnon said at Aulis. The elder lord spoke aloud before them, and here is a quotation from Agamemnon. My fate is angry if I disobey these, but angry if I slaughter this child, the beauty of my house, with maiden bloodshed staining these father's hands beside the altar. What of these things goes now without disaster? How shall I fail my ships and lose my faith of battle? For them to urge such sacrifice of innocent blood, angrily, for their wrath is great, it is right. May all be well yet. He chose, Agamemnon did, as we know, to kill Iphigenia. And the chorus goes on to describe that in great detail. Agamemnon's bringing her there to the altar, her looking at her father with pitiful glances. They describe it right up to the last moment. When Iphigenia is on the altar, and they can't bring themselves to tell the rest. But may all turn out well. What will be, you can't change destiny, and so on. As the chorus fluctuates between support and foreboding, Clytemnestra appears on stage, forceful and effective from the start. She arrives with the news that Troy has fallen. Just last night. How in the world can she know? Who told you this? Asked the chorus. Hephaestus, the fire god. And then she explains the beacons. She had organized a relay of beacons, fire signals, stretching all the way from Troy to Argos. At the fall of Troy, the first fire was lit atop a mountain near Troy. Seeing that from afar, the next man lit his beacon, and so the fires brought the news to the watchman atop the palace in Argos. This is masterful. And she describes it with great mastery. In a long speech, she gives us a geographical sweep, an overview of where all these beacons were and how the signals were passed along. As the chorus dithers, wonders, Clytemnestra has been planning, acting, taking charge. Now, the chorus respond to this news, as we expect, with great rejoicing. Wonderful. But that joy begins to sour even as they're singing that first song, so excited about Troy having fallen. Wonderful that Agamemnon is coming home, but not everybody is coming home from this war. Some have already returned from the Trojan War, ashes in urns, brought back to Argos, and there's muttering in the city against the war. There's danger. There's danger in too much success. I, says the chorus, I wouldn't want to be in Agamemnon's shoes. I wouldn't want to be a victorious general. They've gone from this great rejoicing to this sort of foreboding doom, gloom in the space of just one short song. At the end of it, Agamemnon's herald arrives from Troy, having taken a more conventional route than the beacon signals. The Argive elders listen to him for the news. They hang on every word, but Clytemnestra doesn't need him. She already knows everything she needs to know. She has no patience for his report. Agamemnon himself finally arrives halfway through the play that's named after him. He comes on stage in a chariot of some sort, bringing with him his most cherished war prize, the Trojan princess Cassandra. Clytemnestra greets him with long speeches. Oh, how I've suffered in your absence, but now all is well. Do come inside the palace, Agamemnon. But after all your success, don't let your great feet touch the earth. And she spreads before him cloths, rich fabrics, dyed red, some shade of red, purple, crimson, rich, expensive cloth she lays out before him. But Agamemnon is hesitant to walk on these fabrics. Here's what he says. I am a mortal, a man. I cannot trample upon these tinted splendors without fear thrown in my path. I tell you, as a man, not God, to reverence me, discordant is the murmur at such treading down of lovely things. He absolutely does not want to walk on these rich fabrics, but Clytemnestra persists, begging him to do it in a line-by-line exchange, a stichomathia. And Agamemnon, in this passage, finally yields. He says, does such a victory as this means so much to you? And she responds, oh, yield, the power is yours. Give way of your free will. And he does, saying, since you must have it, here, let someone with all speed take off these sandals, slaves, for my feet to tread upon. And as I crush these garments stained from the rich sea, let no god's eyes of hatred strike me from afar. Great the extravagance, and great the shame I feel to spoil such treasure and such silver's worth of webs. Into the palace he walks, trampling on these carpets, these fabrics, and will never see him again alive. This is pure theater. No mythical version includes this so-called carpet scene. Clytemnestra will indeed kill her husband, but she's going to do it off stage where we can't see it. So what Aeschylus has done is to use this scene to bring before us in the audience the conflict. It's brought right here before our eyes. It's not a physical conflict, but a verbal conflict. And Clytemnestra wins. Agamemnon might be the conqueror of Troy, but he's no match for the cleverness, the trickery, the deception of his wife. And think about it in terms of spectacle, looking at it from the audience. The stage was probably fairly spare, the set, few props. Clytemnestra, standing in the doorway to the palace, welcoming Agamemnon home, but also effectively blocking the door, refusing to let Agamemnon in unless he does it on her terms. And then we see this sea of red pouring out of the palace as if a river of blood flowing out of the house. Okay, we know the story. So after Agamemnon has gone inside, we expect any second to hear his death cries from within. But no, Aeschylus has other plans. He wants to situate this story into the larger history of the house. And so, Cassandra, brought back from Troy by Agamemnon, begins to speak to do just that, set these events into the past as well as the future. Cassandra has prophetic powers given to her once by Apollo in exchange for certain favors. When Cassandra didn't follow through, Apollo added another gift, we might say. She can still prophesy, but no one will ever believe her. Cassandra now uses her prophetic powers to see bloodshed, both past and future, in the house. The house, she says, is dripping with blood. She recognizes that horrors, particularly the Feast of Thyestes, have taken place in this house. She sees, hovering above the house as if shadows, the children holding their own flesh in their hands as food to eat, the flesh that their father ate, grisly images and graphic. And she also foresees the imminent death of Agamemnon and of herself. Now, the members of the chorus, the Argive elders, do not understand or believe her. Maybe it's because of that second gift from Apollo. Nobody's going to believe her. But the general obtuseness of this chorus, their general unwillingness to face the facts, seems enough to explain their inability to understand. Cassandra enters the palace, knowing that she goes to her own imminent death. And in fact, the murders then follow quickly. They take place off stage, and we do hear Agamemnon's death cries. Soon after that, Clytemnestra appears back on stage. She appears on this wheeled platform, the Euclema. What it does is bring out onto the stage a scene from the interior. And what she brings with her are the bodies of those that she's just killed. On the Euclema, she stands there over these two dead bodies, Agamemnon and Cassandra. And what is her attitude? At first, at least, she is absolutely exultant. She finally speaks openly. All along, it's been nothing but lies. Finally, Clytemnestra speaks openly, and she claims full responsibility for the murder, even describing it as a sacrifice to Zeus. Here is what she says, the blood-spattered Clytemnestra. Standing above the bodies of Agamemnon and Cassandra, I stand now where I struck him down. The thing is done. Thus have I wrought, and I will not deny it now, that he might not escape nor beat aside his death. As fishermen cast their huge circling nets, I spread deadly abundance of rich robes and caught him fast. I struck him twice. In two great cries of agony, he buckled at the knees and fell. When he was down, I struck him the third blow in thanks and reverence to Zeus, the lord of dead men underneath the ground. Thus he went down, and the life struggled out of him. And as he died, he spattered me with the dark, red, and violent, driven rain of bitter, savored blood to make me glad. As gardens stand among the showers of God in glory at the birth time of the buds. This, I hope you'll agree, is perverse. Her husband's blood showering her like spring rains, so welcome, causing new buds to grow. The chorus is outraged, and in response, Clytemnestra begins to justify her act, primarily as a proper return for Agamemnon's killing of Iphigenia. Cassandra, she says, was just an extra, a sort of a relish at the side of the plate, a delicate excitement to my bed's delight, says Clytemnestra. Yes, her bed. Only now, and in response to threats from the chorus, Clytemnestra mentions that she does indeed have a man to protect her, Aegisthus, who makes the fire shine on her hearth. Remember, he is the son of Thyestes, that one who was not part of the feast, who survived the feast. That makes Aegisthus a cousin of Agamemnon and, given the relations between their fathers, a bitter enemy. Aegisthus didn't go to Troy, but spent his time back in Argos, in Agamemnon's palace, with Agamemnon's wife. Now, different versions of the story give Aegisthus a larger or smaller role in the murder of Agamemnon. Aeschylus clearly keeps Clytemnestra front and center, Aegisthus in a subordinate role. Back to Clytemnestra and her justification. He killed, she says, and so he deserved to die. The chorus, so loyal to Agamemnon, and after some time hearing this justification, they recognize that there's some truth in what she says. Yes, he killed. He killed Iphigenia. Maybe he does deserve to die. But this principle of revenge, this idea that the doer should suffer, contains unpleasant implications, we might say, for Clytemnestra herself. And here, for the first time in this play, we detect perhaps a bit of uneasiness in Clytemnestra, an unwillingness to face the reality. Here, this is what she says, in response to the chorus recognizing that, yes, bloodshed follows bloodshed. Well, let's start with the chorus saying that. The chorus recognizes it. Here is anger for anger. Between them, who shall judge lightly? The spoiler is robbed. He killed, he has paid. The truth stands ever beside God's throne eternal. He who has wrought shall pay. That is law. Then who shall tear the curse from their blood? The seed is stiffened to ruin. You'd think that Clytemnestra would be pleased that the chorus has finally bought into her justification. This is how she responds. You see truth in the future at last. Yet, I wish to seal my oath with the spirit in the house. I will endure all things as they stand now, hard though it be. Hereafter, let him go forth to make bleed with death and guilt the houses of others. I will take some small measure of our riches and be content that I swept from these halls the murder, the sin, and the fury. She wants it both ways. Now that I've killed, she says, let's let all the killing stop. At this point, Aegisthus enters, almost as an afterthought, and he tries to take credit for the murder. The chorus has nothing but scorn for him, a womanish man waiting out the war in Agamemnon's bed. He calls out his bodyguard, and the play ends. In the next lecture, we move on to the other two plays in the trilogy. And we might keep these questions in mind, questions raised by this first play. If the expedition to Troy was sanctioned by the gods, was Agamemnon right to kill his daughter? On the other hand, is Clytemnestra justified in killing the killer of her daughter? What happens when the demands of society come into conflict with the demands of the family? The male, Agamemnon, chose his social role as king. The female chose her family role as mother. Is there some sort of divine plan or order behind these deeds? And if so, what does it portend for the future? In the next lecture, the rest of the Oresteia, Libation Bearers and Eumenides.